5th. The appropriate information is behind tab 8 in your binder. I'm going to skip over the initial part of the report on the funding because John Hoey is here and he has an update on that, which makes some of the information provided here erroneous. So I'll jump to the first thing we discussed, which was a discussion with the people from the Office of Sustainable Fisheries on moving the eliminator trawl into the fishery. That was proceeding well, and it should be part of Framework 47. We also had a discussion on the broader issue of how new gears could be adopted in a more efficient and streamlined manner in anticipation of new gear configurations in the future. That's an ongoing discussion. We're trying to find ways that to not buttonhole this gear, not to make it, like the rule trawls defined right now, it can only be that size net. We're trying to come up with, variations to so that the gear can be fitted to the doors and the horsepower of the vessels that tow it. On another note, we had a long discussion on the issue of scientific research catch of managed species. If you remember, the council requested that a letter be sent. A letter was sent on June 29th to Eric Schwab, who was then the Assistant Administrator of Fisheries, noting our concern with the ability to fish outside of Magnuson in scientific research. We received an update, and this is an incredibly complicated issue that seems as though it should be simple, but what it amounts to is that the councils have the authority to regulate fishing under Magnuson Stevens, but the Act specifically exempts scientific research from scientific research vessels from the definition of fishing. These limitations extend to all activities associated with such research, including reporting requirements, sale of catch, and amount of catch that can be allowed or authorized. And because of this, there's this is a big loophole here with a tremendous potential for abuse. The committee is concerned that with rapidly declining funding for research, that scientific institutions may take advantage of this loophole, and this will undermine our ability to manage the fisheries. So at the end of a very lengthy and complicated discussion, the committee members expressed the desire to minimally establish some reporting requirements so that catch can be accounted for within the management plan. And we had a consensus statement, which is top of page 3, which says the committee would like to request NOAA General Counsel clarify their interpretation of the Act that the agency cannot require either the vessel or the research institution to report its catch. And I don't know if anybody has any questions on that. Okay, I'll move on then. After this, we moved on to have a discussion about a proof of concept project that's being run by a man named Glenn Chamberlain, a researcher at UMass Dartmouth. He gave us a presentation on this. It's a camera system to try and identify catch as it comes on board. It's in the proof of concept stage. We had a good give and take with him, offered him some ideas of things to look at, and that research is ongoing. Next, we moved on to reviewing final reports. We received 5 final reports at this meeting. I'll note these were all Northeast Consortium projects that had technical reviews from the consortium, and so I don't have to say it 5 times. I'll just say that the committee accepted all the comments of the reviewers as adequate and correct. The first report, I'll run through them very briefly. The first report was called PULSE, a Cooperative Partnership for Pelagic Ocean Ecosystem Monitoring in the Gulf of Maine, with co-PIs Jeff Runge and Rebecca Jones. This is a study of a plankton, Calanus species. Fishermen refer to it as red feed, and this is a lipid-rich copepod that is the primary prey for adult herring and the northern right whale. And I can also tell you from years of fishing for them, mackerel. a lot of this stuff. The committee adopted a consensus statement to accept the report and to forward it to the herring and habitat plan development teams, as well as to staff involved in ecosystems-based fisheries management and protected resources. The committee would like to draw particular attention to the hypothesis on page 12 of the report, postulating the relationship between adult herring and aggregations of a particular Callinus species. There's two major species here, but only one of them seems to be of primary interest to a number of these animals. And I would advise you to take a look at that. This is a good report. It has a lot of information in it. It'll have a lot of use in the future. The second report was the use of kites in shrimp caught ends to reduce small shrimp and bycatch species, co-authored by Pingo He and Dan Schick. And this was a look at putting kites in the caught end to basically expand the meshes more with the hopes that small fish and small shrimp would escape. The results of this experiment did not support this hypothesis. It was called to our attention at the meeting that a man named Barry O'Neill of the Aberdeen Lab has done considerable research into the effects of caught end loading on mesh shape and size, and the committee agreed that this research may contribute to future work and recommend that people take a look at it. The consensus on this report was to forward it to the research community for information purposes. It has no use in management at this time. Third report was building on promise, continued investigation into using a four-seam bottom trawl to improve escapement of small haddock and cod by Dana Morse. This experiment had limited success in releasing small cod and haddock. Again, you can read the report, but the consensus of the committee was that this project has no immediate application for management, but should be kept on file for future reference. The report was accepted. Fourth report, Saco Bay Scallop Stock Enhancement Project, authored by Heather Deese Reardon. And this was a lengthy project. It suffered a number of setbacks, went on for a long period of time. Different researchers, different fishery participants. And it's an interesting study from a sociological and anthropological point of view, because it shows quite clearly what happens when you try to do something that perhaps members of the community aren't really interested in. The project suffered from quite a bit of vandalism of the equipment. This was done in Saco Bay, heavily lobstered area. Apparently some lobstermen felt threatened by the project, that it might reestablish a scallop fishery in that area. And at any rate, it was, you know, it never really was able to do what it set out to do. The report has, again, no immediate application for management, but should be retained on file. And, again, I would recommend that people who are considering doing work such as this in a community at least make sure the community actually wants the work done first, because, obviously, if they don't want it done, your chances of success are very small. The final report was activity and distribution of cod in the Ipswich Bay spawning area. This was authored by Hunt Howell from UNH, Dr. Howell. I'll note for the record that I was part of that project. I offered to recuse myself from the discussions or answer questions from the back of the room, but people didn't feel that was necessary. Kyle Bouchard's also here. He was part of that project as well as a couple other fishermen. And what we did in this experiment is we tagged cod that were on the verge of spawning, and then with acoustic tags, and then attempted to follow them around the spawning grounds. It was quite successful. We were able to do it. We were able to demonstrate spawning site fidelity, how long the fish stay there, and what happens when they leave. And the answer is, when they leave, they really leave quick. It's pretty interesting. Some of you will remember that you created the whaleback spawning stock protection area last year. That was based largely on this work. And this is the final report from that. What you based it on was a peer-reviewed journal article that had already been published. Specifically, the project demonstrated, as I said, spawning stock fidelity. It also confirmed that cod experienced barrel traumas upon release, characterized by uneven and sporadic vertical movements with up to 18 days required for behavior to return to normal. project characterized vertical movements of cod and how they vary from area to area and temporally. All of these results have applications to management, for example, informing a discussion on suitability of properly defined spawning closures, as well as scientific aspects. For example, the influence of vertical movements on catchability in bottom trawls may affect the outcome of stock assessments based on trawl surveys. And I call your attention to that last point particularly. Keep that in the back of your head, because we're going to have a big discussion tomorrow about Gulf of Maine cod and selectivity in trawls. So anyway, the consensus on that report was the committee accepts the report and agrees with the conclusions, with some concern that it is based on only 1 year of data. The members of the committee would have liked to have seen 2 or 3 years of work done. So would the people who are doing the work, but that's the nature of funding. So we don't have any sense of interannual variability. But based on the fact that I can tell you from personal experience that we've monitored this area now for the better part of 15 years with one project or another on a fairly continuing basis, that there is great fidelity to this area by these fish, both through the tagging studies, through this study, and through work we did last year, which is still in publication, with an acoustic survey, which showed a very high concentration of fish in that area in May. So that concludes my report, and if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Going back to the first consensus statement concerning the committee would like to request of NOAA General Counsel to clarify
yes.
their interpretation of the Act, the chair would like to request to ask Gene or George, do you need anything more formal from us? Should that come to the council and have the council vote on a request for that, or is this something that you can work with the way it is?
I guess I'd prefer it be a more formal request, is exactly lay out what you're asking.
Okay, so we would have to have a motion to that effect to request that the council make this request of NOAA General Counsel.
Would you like me to make that motion, Mr. Chair?
Well, the chair would entertain that motion, yes.
Okay. Then I will move as an individual, not on behalf of the committee, that the council request that NOAA General Counsel clarify their interpretation of the Act that the agency cannot require either the vessel or the research institution to report its catch.
Is there a second to that, Dave Preble? Discussion. Gene.
I guess I would direct this just to National Marine Fisheries Service, because it's not necessarily just a legal interpretation, and that way we can coordinate our response to this.
My assumption is that you could clarify that by just eliminating GC after NOAA, or maybe it should be more specific to the Northeast Regional Office or to NOAA. Is that?
I would just say National Marine Fisheries Service.
So change it to NIMS. Okay, that's good. The language is correct.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Phil, how does this relate to the letter we already sent to NIMS and the response we got that they were looking into it?
That letter was more about the disposition of catch, accountability, the sale of catch. Those were the concerns. And as we delved into the problem, one of the concerns is just reporting of the catch, and that wasn't specific in that first letter.
Anyone else on the council? Glenn.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I think we're missing a couple words on the bottom line now. The Research Institute to report its catch.
Thank you. That's okay. Thank you. That's okay with the seconder?
Yes.
Thank you, Glenn. Anyone else on the council? Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think most folks know that the research funding heyday in New England is kind of waning. We used to have several millions of dollars in the cooperative research funding and the Northeast Consortium funding, SMAS funding. There's been a number of funding avenues, venues for research, and those are drying up. And our funding for research steering committee has also dried up, so we do not have the funds that we got from NIMS to support this effort. And I've talked to the chairman and budget and things, and we have the funding for this year, and we feel that the research steering committee has been invaluable and offers a great service to research and coordinating and steering research in the region. And Dave's done a great job of real dedicated work on that. So we're funding it this year, but next year, you know, may be a different story. And also at the national level, where Jim and I attended the CCC meeting, there's only, I think, $2.4 million available nationally for collaborative research. And Washington or Silver Spring is coordinating some national research projects, especially on bycatch. And I don't know if we knew about that or getting input to that funding. But there was also talk about the need to, if we want to continue research and tie it to management, that the research set-aside programs have been very valuable, at least in our SCALA program. It's been great, so we might want to look towards that. Thank you.
Go to the audience. Any comments? Back to the council. Sally McGee.
This is confusing to me, in part because one of the things that we talked about at the Groundfish Committee meeting last is the need for more information flowing into the management system to understand what's happening with fish stocks. So if if there's a particular situation that was a problem, then I guess I would understand this, but if there's a way to be providing more information to managers, then why would we want to put up any kind of barrier to a flow of information? I mean, I understand that you're saying that you wouldn't be required, but, at the same time, considering the need for more information, and if a project is funded by federal sources, then that information should be going back to the agency with, you know, whatever kind of scrubbing needs to be done to make sure that there aren't any proprietary concerns. That would make sense, but otherwise this does not make sense to me in the context that we're working in where we need more information. So why would we want to put up any barriers to prevent information collected from helping improve our understanding of stocks? Thank you.
I don't want to put words into the research steering committee's mouth, but I think the intent is what you really want, which is more information. Do you want to clarify that, Dave?
Yeah.
Dave Gaethel?
The problem is that research conducted outside of Magnuson isn't covered by Magnuson reporting requirements. And what we're asking through this motion is for clarification of the interpretation of the Act that the agency cannot require information conducted outside of Magnuson. And we are hoping that they will come back and say, yes, we can, in fact, do that, and that research conducted outside of Magnuson will be at least required to report what they caught. Right now, they're not required to do anything. As I think we had this discussion before. If I team up with, for example, I'll use Hunt Howell because I work with him a lot, and we decide not to seek federal funding but to go out and, I don't know, study how many sea flies live in the mouth of a large cod in a whaleback spawning area, and then we go out and catch 1 million pounds of cod to look down their throats and see how many sea lice are in there, I don't have to report that catch. I don't have to fill out a logbook. I can sell it. Nothing. There's absolutely nothing to keep that from happening as long as the scientific institution goes along with it. Now, so far, that's only happened a handful of times. The scientific institutions, is by and large, work through Magnuson. But we can all see a day, as Paul said, when funding dries up, and in, you know, the world of academia, it's publish or perish, and people may be attempted, you know, maybe then interested in, you know, doing research outside of Magnuson because it's the only way they can do research. So this has the potential to be a very serious problem, especially in groundfish in New England where tax are so low.
Anyone else on the council? Seeing none, I will call a question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. 14. Looks almost unanimous. Have one abstention. So that's 14-0-1. The motion carries. Back to you, Dave Gaethel.
Okay, did anybody have any questions on any of the final reports? Okay. I don't know how you...
Jim Odlin and then David Pierce.
Dave, when you mentioned the Eliminator trawl, you mentioned that... Are you guys actively involved in recommending some changes to the way they're describing that trawl?
Let me try and give you the history of this. The service came back to the council staff in the summer, I can't remember exactly when, and wanted some clarifications on some issues. We held a conference call in August and addressed those concerns, and then the Office of Sustainable Fisheries came to have a discussion with us in November about how they had implemented the results of that conference call. And the paragraph here on the top of page 2, the second paragraph, describes that conversation. Now, if Phil wants to add anything further.
So you're done with it now?
To my knowledge, we're done with it. It's in Framework 47, and the only thing we're still working on is the part at the very bottom of that paragraph, which is to try and come up with, so we don't have to do this on a case-by-case basis, some kind of generic language that allows bycatch reduction gears to be moved into management in a way that doesn't pigeonhole the gear to just one particular size and one particular horsepower.
Dave Pierce.
Yeah, David, a couple of the reports really caught my attention. The last one that you referenced is that the activity and distribution of cod in the Ipswich Bay spawning areas that work that you were involved in. Obviously, this council spent a lot of time dealing with the issue of protecting spawning cod, so I assume that this particular report will play a major role, or at least it should, as we move forward to deal with Gulf of Maine cod issues that will be dealt with tomorrow at length. Spawning site fidelity, yeah, absolutely. The Division of Marine Fisheries has done a lot of research on this as well. But the question I have that relates to this specific work is one that relates to the sentence that you've referenced. The project also confirmed that cod experienced barotraumas upon release, characterized by uneven and sporadic vertical movements with up to 18 days required for behavior to return to normal. Did the report provide any information regarding how this particular finding might relate to discard mortality of cod? And did the committee have any draw any conclusions relative to that very important issue for discard mortality of cod? And I ask the question because Again, we'll talk about it tomorrow, but in GARM 3, there was an assumption of 100% survival of all hook-released fish and other releases of cod, and now we're assuming 100% mortality. So to what extent will this report and that finding perhaps influence our discussions and decisions tomorrow?
It did not address the issue of discard mortality specifically. I would say basically we tagged 50 fish, so it's a small number of fish. We tagged them with these DST tags, which are depth sensors as well. Now, the only ones of those that we could study are the ones that were recaptured. We followed the fish around with the acoustic aspect of it, but the ones that were recaptured were a smaller subset of the 50. I can tell you that based on the acoustic work, we're quite sure that one fish died because we could find him in the same place to tag, the acoustic tag, every single time we went out. However, we did locate every other fish at least once, and they had all moved from where they were tagged. So it is assumed that all the rest of the fish lived. Now, the 18 days comes from these fish that were recaptured, and when you look at the depth aspect of the tag, you see initially this up and down vertical movement that lasted up to 18 days before the fish basically resumed normal activity, which is swimming very close to the bottom and really relatively little movement during the spawning period. After they spawned, the same tags show a resumption of sometimes vast vertical movements, coinciding with leaving the Western Gulf of Maine spawning area. Sometimes you'll have to go and reference the report. I don't want to put out numbers that aren't accurate, but, you know, 50 meters wouldn't be uncommon, as an example. And the fish exhibited that movement basically for 3 or 4 months after leaving the spawning area, which would tend to indicate that cod spend a pretty good amount of time off bottom when they're not spawning. And that is the reference to this last sentence, which obviously has implications for stock assessment. You know, this whole issue of cryptic biomass, if you will, the same issue that came up with pollock, that basically the only way the pollock assessment seemed to start working is when you assumed that the fish were spending some portion of their time off bottom and were unavailable to patrol. And that's separate from the issue of dome selectivity about whether or not a large cod can outswim the net in a short period of time.
And one other question regarding the reports. And actually, the question that I have is for Jim Weinberg or for Bill relative to the work done with Calanus and Marchicus with that copepod that is so critical to the ecosystem in the Gulf of Maine and elsewhere. I appreciate the fact that the committee is calling our attention to that report, which covers a so-called plankton monitoring program from 2003 to 2005. Yes, indeed, Calanus finmarchicus is extremely important to sea herring, and it's not a new thing. We've known that since the 1950s, the 1940s. So the hypothesis has sort of stood the test of time. Because we're getting into ecosystem-based management in a major way, we're having all sorts of discussions about productivity and the impact of lack of productivity on Gulf of Maine cod and other species. Does the Northeast Fisheries Science Center have a plankton monitoring program that would enable us to better understand the implications of changes in abundance of this particular copepod, never mind the other ones?
Well, I'm not a real well-versed in being able to answer this question, but I know that we do have an ecosystem group that's very active. Historically, the group at our Narragansett Laboratory has studied the ecosystem off our coast and for the last 2 or 3 years at least has published annually an ecosystem report that talks about the productivity of waters and probably zooplankton and phytoplankton. But I haven't the expertise to comment on the particulars in those reports. But I know there's activity in that direction.
Mr. Chairman, Dave, just to follow up, I think this is clearly an important area, and as you've remarked, it's not something that's new. And I was actually surprised to see that this report that was presented, the data collection terminated in 2005. So there's a lack of current information in there, which I'd like to follow up on. I can't answer specifically all of the details of the survey activities at the Science Center, just because I haven't been there long enough. But it is something that I will also follow up on, because I think it really is something we need to be aware of, and I need to understand a little bit more about exactly what work we're doing relative to this.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question probably for Dave Gaethel. Without the possibility of an untagged control group in this COD study, how was the determination or the conclusion drawn that you were looking at barotrauma when the same behavior was observed after spawning had stopped at a later point in the year?
I think it was based on the type of movement. It was very erratic movement as opposed to the movement after spawning, which was very regular. The fish appeared to have very erratic movements initially on their way down. They would go down, stop, basically appear to, neutralize the pressure, get down some more, stop, almost like a diver. But then when they reached the bottom, they started doing up and down off-bottom movements, probably and again, this is an assumption. I mean, obviously we have no way of going down there and actually viewing them. They started this off-bottom movement for a period of time. Most of the fish, it wasn't 18 days. That was the longest. And then before settling down and resuming what you would think of as normal cod behavior.
Anyone else on the council? Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, just one last thing. Dr. Hoey's here, and he can address Paul's questions about funding, I believe, if you'd like to entertain him.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and council members. We have a little bit more of an optimistic view from the report we provided at the end of January. At that time, we were instructed to plan for a 50% reduction in our budget, and since then the numbers have come back in, and the statements in the initial part that talk about how we at one point had a dedicated northeast line, and then that transitioned in the last 2 years to a portion of the sector funds. We received basically $6 million out of sector funds in 10 and 11. Instead of getting a 50% reduction in that, we got roughly a 17%. So the number, instead of getting $6 million, we basically have 4.98 out of that. So in terms of the planning, what we're doing is we're looking through the established contracts that we put in place, GearNet, ChemFin, some of the bycatch reduction activities and the data collection activities for temporal spatial management. And we're looking at the outstanding balances of those, because those contracts establish a framework very similar to the one that the council works in. We operate within the agency with one-year money. Once we establish those contracts, you can have a 3 to 4 year period of performance. So several of the projects that we funded last year are sitting on very large outstanding balances, in some cases several hundred thousand dollars. And those decisions on how to establish the levels of funding and the periods of performance were designed to try and bridge somewhat what we knew was going to be a very difficult time. At the same time, we know that of those projects, there are one or two that may require a little extra funding, so we're looking at them and going to start those discussions. And the priority in terms of setting what we will spend the money on is to try and maintain our capacity within the Science Center to continue supporting those activities to some extent, so we all hit the wall together, because it really doesn't do us much good to have external partners who then have no one to report to or to try and run research set-aside projects when there's no funding for the administrative staff. So as things stand now, we will continue our core activities and the core activities that were funded with our external partners under the network programs that we established last year. It looks like we do have the money. I guess Paul and I can talk about the $90K we've traditionally provided for the Research Steering Committee. I have that as a must-pay, so we do have the funds for that. I can also provide the supplementary funds to maintain the full coverage of the Maine New Hampshire Inshore Survey. That has a separate line that was taxed, and then I usually add out of our cooperative research budget enough funds to make sure that we maintain the time series for that survey. And we also have about $200K that we can afford to invest in continuing the marine resource education program. That leaves me then with roughly 180K, and then we're waiting for final budgets out of the national program next week. So we have somewhere in the neighborhood of available funds that I need to use to look at the network funds between maybe $200,000 and maybe $700,000. The problem is I have received $7.2 million in requested funds through the BAA. That would be the continuation of the Commercial Fisheries Research Foundation. They're requesting money for a four-year extension. The Northeast Consortium. We have a socioeconomic proposal from both the state of New Hampshire, New Hampshire Sea Grant, and the Commercial Fisheries Research Foundation. There's an SMAS request for an oceanographic assessment work. And then there's a collaborative research fellowship program that was started by the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, UNH, and SMAS to basically offer training for young fishery scientists to work explicitly in cooperative research. So with $700,000, you obviously can't fund $7 million, and those are the decisions that I'm going to be working through with Bill. And after we review the existing contracts we have, I think everybody will be whole till probably the second quarter of fiscal year 13, by which time we'll have the 13 budget, and we'll know what programs will have to be terminated.
Dave Gaethel.
If there's no further questions, that concludes my report.
Anybody have questions for Dr. Hoey? Go to the audience. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you. Now we will move into the period for open public comment. We would entertain comments on any subjects that are relevant to council business but not otherwise listed on the agenda for this meeting. Is there anybody who would like to speak? I can't see whose hand that. Hey, Jim.
Good morning, folks. It's a pleasure to see some of your smiling faces again, but I wish the hell I weren't here. I should be fishing. But I want to take this opportunity to bring you up to speed on the Atlantic, the traditional small boat Atlantic herring fishery here in New England. I think it's very important that everybody understand what's going on this year. You really don't have to be a genius to figure that out. I mean, any parking lot that doesn't have its own Swiss Alps piled up with snow, that is traditional, and it had a very significant effect on the fish behavior this year, extremely significant. But I want to start out with just letting you all know that this is probably, without a doubt, the most fun fishery that I've been in since the 70s on the Grand Banks of Flemish Cap, catching 250-pound swordfish. It's extremely rewarding because you actually enter contracts for your price before you start, 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 for your price before you